Of the many wine bibliographies I read, Jane Lopez's Vignette has to be one of my favorites. The book picked and maintained my interest throughout the whole length. Her passion for wine and struggle in her private life transpire in the book and beyond it. This episode differs from others that I have released so far, in that it is focused on the life story of the author in and out of the book, but nonetheless, I wanted to shine a light on it, and I invite everybody to listen to this inspiring story. In the first part, I spoke to Jane about some of the events and emotions that she had gone through, from the beginning when she first became interested in wine, through the stress of her examination to become one of the few master sommeliers in the world, only to see it taken away in a matter of months. She shows amazing resilience and devotion, and through her story there is something that many people can relate to. In the second part, we spoke about the recent sexual harassment expose in the New York Times that Jane and other 20 women were part of, regarding the malpractice of senior member of the Court of Sommelier in the USA. Jane shares with me how the long plan and research article came together, how she had felt about it all, and what she hopes for the future. I can only thank her for sharing her story here. Hi, I'm Mattia Scarpazza, and this is the Looking Into Wine podcast. Wine and winemaking can be complex, but this podcast has a simple mission. We want to give you the skills and tools to harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, process, and concept that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you enjoy the show and your own journey, Looking Into Wine. Welcome to Looking Into Wine. I'm Mattia Scarpazza, and today's guest is Jane Lopes. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Jane, you are the author of Vignette, and I have read your book, and I found a quote that you use for describing it as an educational and emotional guide to wine, and I couldn't agree more. Why do you describe it as such?
Yeah, so the book is a combination between personal narrative. I don't love the word memoir. I feel like I'm too young to have a memoir, but personal narrative and wine education. So, you know, each chapter kind of narrates a story from my life. And it follows a pretty kind of linear path of my life story to this point. And you know, each chapter will kind of focus around a style of wine or spirits, or in one occasion beer. And you know, it'll kind of explain why that style kind of figured importantly at a time in my life. So, you know, maybe, and this is something, you know, ever since I've worked in wine, I really remember, I think like most people in our industry do, I really remember the wines I drink quite well. I remember, you know, what I was drinking in certain moments of my life. And so, you know, these beverages become very kind of tied to emotions and to experiences. So I narrate that. So you get kind of some of my life story kind of coming up in the wine industry, and how kind of I emotionally relate to beverages. But then at the end of each chapter, there's some sort of educational bit. And I try to make it really fun and engaging. You know, I didn't want it to be dry, and I wasn't trying to write, you know, a wine encyclopedia. It's not supposed to be sort of an all-encompassing educational book, but I just took something that I thought was important about that style of beverage, and I tried to create a piece of content that I thought would be engaging both to experts, so kind of a new way of looking at something for experts, but also really, you know, accessible for the novice. So they're very visual, these bits. They're maps and charts and illustrations, and yeah, just kind of meant to elucidate the style, but also just have a bit of fun.
While I was reading it, really, you can sort of, if you didn't have any emotional attachment to a style of wine, or maybe you can find it through reading your own stories, and which you developed very well, and I think it gives that extra edge to the book, and I think it's brilliant. And it was one of the first one book that I read cover to cover.
Oh,
and
amazing.
I first read the story, and then I went back to see the different vignettes, which is the title of the book. And obviously, wanted to ask, was it your storyline that affected the wine choices, or was the wine that you chose around that?
Well, most of them actually happen. So most of them are, you know, it's real events, and it's the real beverages that were drink. And so they kind of, you know, arose together. You know, obviously I wasn't going to narrate the stories had to be either significant because of the beverage, but more often than not, it was significant because of the life event. So, you know, I do a chapter kind of about my aha wine, which was, you know, an 80s white Burgundy that I drank in, you know, the mid 2000s. And so that obviously was a chapter that was really about that wine, and the narrative was only existed because of drinking that wine. But a lot of times it was the other way around, where you know, it was a event, it was a, you know, it was a first date or a competition or studying for an exam or a health issue or something like that. And I kind of, you know, I remembered the beverages that existed around that event, even if the beverages weren't, you know, and a crazy special bottle or something like that, that they were just sort of, you know, when I moved into my new apartment, I remember the bottles I drank, and it was just, and maybe they weren't like the most crazy notable bottles on the planet, but I remember them because of the moment in time.
Yeah, they have a significant attached to them. And I wanted to speak a bit about your life stories, because you are born in Napa Valley and you study as Renaissance literature. And then how did you end up working in the wine industry?
Yeah, you know, I studied English literature in Chicago at University of Chicago. You know, U of C is a pretty amazing academic environment. So like a lot of people who go there undergrad, you're kind of like, I want to be in academia forever. So you make your grad school plan. So I was planning to, you know, I was planning to get a PhD in English literature. And so I didn't want to write applications during my senior year, because, you know, that just seemed overwhelming with also doing, you know, a senior thesis and all my coursework and extracurriculars and stuff like that. So I just was going to take a year off. I actually applied to work in the admissions department at University of Chicago, and I didn't get the job, and I was pretty devastated. So I just needed a job. So I was just looking on Craigslist and found, you know, a listing to work in a wine shop. And I'd enjoyed wine since I studied abroad in Italy my junior year in college. But I didn't know much about it. But I was said, you know, hey, that sounds like it'd be a pretty cool like gap year job. And I was lucky that the store manager, who's still a good friend of mine to this day, she'd gone to U of C for grad school. So she just liked me, and we talked about U of C and literature. And luckily she didn't ask me much about wine, because I really didn't know much. So, you know, and so they hired me, and it was a pretty steep learning curve, but I, you know, it got to the point where I was coming home from work and I wanted to study wine. I didn't want to write my my grad school application. So, you know, at a certain point I just said, well, let's see where this goes. Like, I'm not ready to abandon this yet. So, you know, the thought of spending my 20s kind of just in a library versus, you know, wine to me seemed to really encompass so many things that I enjoyed. You know, it is very academic, and I liked to study, and I didn't want to give that up, but it was social, and I got to interact with people, and it was also so tied to sensory experiences, which I really love too. You know, I love that you're studying something and then you can, you know, take a glass and swirl it, and you can really connect a lot of the things that you taste and smell to what you're studying, which I just thought was the coolest thing.
Yeah, that's that practical part of the wine studies. And I guess a lot of people have started a wine journey through either a job opportunity or they look up on a bottle of wine, and it was the beginning of the journey. And but you went very far in your career, and you went from barman to sommelier Tennessee, and then you went to work in New York. How different was to move to New York, and how was your experience there?
Yeah, I mean, New York's an amazing city. I'd actually lived there a few summers. My sister went to school in New York, so a few summers during college, I went and I spent the summer with her. So I spent some time in New York. I knew I really liked it as a city. You know, and Nashville was really good. It was an amazing experience for me, and I'm really grateful to everyone there. I wasn't in the best health while I was there, so I was kind of, but I didn't, I was kind of, I kind of tied my health to my situation, if that makes sense. And I kind of blamed, Nashville for how I was feeling. And I also, I got to the point where I knew I wanted to sort of kick it into high gear with my wine career. And I didn't want to work at a restaurant where I was the most knowledgeable person about wine. You know, I wanted to work somewhere where I was constantly being challenged. And so I moved to New York. You know, New York is a new ballgame. I think, you know, I had been a beverage director at sort of the hottest restaurant in Nashville when I was there. And so I was kind of expecting to be able to come in and sort of get whatever job I wanted, which is not how New York works. So it was definitely a humbling experience. But, you know, it's, I really enjoy that. And it kind of just, for me, it's a challenge, and it sort of just says, okay, it says you have to work harder. So I did, and you know, I eventually got to work at 11 Madison Park as a sommelier, which was incredible, and just a really a huge growth opportunity for me, and just developed a ton there as both my kind of wine knowledge and skills, but just as also a hospitality professional. And that's what it's, you know, that's what it's all about. If you're a sommelier in a restaurant, is providing a good experience. And you can do that through wine knowledge and wine skills. And you can also just do that in terms of like knowing food allergies and your ability to run food and topping up people's water glasses. And, you know, those things are all super important.
Absolutely. I mean, you obviously landed in one of the most, if not the, for many years, one of the most important restaurants in the world. And definitely that was what for you has been one of the most important stage of your career. But while you were doing that and touching on your health, you were suffering of anxieties, and you said all these very difficult stages of your life, and it's very emotional. And while reading it, you almost get to know you through your book. And I wanted to ask, how did you manage your anxiety? Because you were studying for your advanced for the Court of Sommelier at the time. How did you manage it, and how was that experience?
You know, I was probably in the best health of my adult life when I was leading up to the advanced, actually. I would say in the kind of 6 to 8 months directly preceding the advanced exam, I was in a good place. And you know, it's a combination of things. And honestly, I don't totally understand my kind of my health problems to this day, but you know, so it's been more sort of symptom management. But so the advanced was actually pretty good. And I had a bit of an episode at the advance because I took some kind of real extra strength Sudafed, which, you know, is not legal to buy over the counter in the US anymore, because it's what you use to make meth. So it's very much a stimulant, which I'm very sensitive to, and I kind of hadn't focused on that when I decided to take some. You know, I think like everyone going into these exams, you're like super paranoid about your sinuses because you're going into a tasting exam and you need to be able to smell. So, you know, it was like everyone was popping Sudafed. And it basically, you know, I don't know if you call it a panic attack or an allergic reaction or whatever, but I was having kind of a panic attack in terms of like my heart was racing, but I also like couldn't move. I was like passed out on my hotel bed and like finally was able to call down to the kind of the hotel front desk, and they called the local hospital. And so I went to the emergency room the night before my advanced exam started. But you know, honestly, as soon as the medication left my system, it was a rough, you know, 6 hours, 8 hours. And the next morning I was fine. Of course, everyone at the exam at that point knew that I'd gone to the hospital the night before. And so everyone's like, are you okay? And so, you know, I think I wasn't really dealing with the lead up to the advanced exam in the way that I was the master's exam. You know, the first time I took the master's exam in 2015, and by that point you had to take theory first and pass theory before the other two sections, I was not in a good place, and I had kind of just started at 11 Madison Park and was working a ton and was exhausted, and then was also just trying to keep up with my studies. And you know, in hindsight, my knowledge just wasn't there and I wasn't ready to pass. And so I took, at that point, after I didn't pass the 2015 theory, I didn't feel like I kind of excel at 11 Madison Park and also really prepare well for the exam. So I just took a year off, and I was gearing up to take it again in 2017. And I was going to leave 11 Madison Park. I gave my notice in November of 2016, and just was going to take time off and study and write this book, was kind of the plan. And you know, of course, plans never work out. And you know, as soon as a former manager at 11 Madison Park was working at this restaurant in Australia called Attica, and as soon as I told him I gave my notice, he said, well, great, why don't you come to Australia and be our wine director at Attica, which, you know, is, we're at first, you know, just were like, that's crazy. We're not gonna move to Australia. That's crazy. But, you know,
it's done.
John, my, you know, husband now, my not even fiance, my boyfriend at the time, we just talked about it. We're like, why not? You know, this is the time in our lives where we should go off and experience a new country, you know, especially one that has such amazing wine regions and restaurants, and you know, it's the same language we speak roughly. So it was a pretty easy transition, you know. So yeah, we just said why not, and we moved to Australia. So then I felt like, okay, I need to really focus on my work at Attica. I can't take the MS exam this year, and so that I was gearing up for it in 2018. And then, you know, I was actually feeling pretty good in the months leading up to the theory portion. Between theory and tasting and service, my health took a bit of a nosedive, and I really was really, really stressed. And I think part of it was the stress of going into a service and a tasting exam. You know, those are things that are really so dependent on how you're kind of feeling and performing on that day. And, you know, I can tell you a lot of things that I did. I don't know if anything was that effective. I think the most effective thing I did was just to say, okay, I'm not going to feel good. I'm going to be anxious, and it's going to be okay. You know, like,
yeah, you upset it, and it worked out.
Yeah. Where where I wasn't trying to get myself to a point where I wasn't going to feel anxiety, because that just wasn't realistic. So I just kind of tried to accept it and you know, do my best despite the challenges.
Absolutely. And how was moving to Australia? What was the biggest difference between like working in the US and moving to Australia?
You know, Australia is, I mean, we loved it. We had a great time over there and we just fell in love with the wine and the wine regions. And, you know, Australia is definitely a country that values work-life balance more than the US, probably more than a lot of countries. And, you know, especially Attica was, you know, the hours were really forgiving, you know, especially for a management position. It was, you know, compared to what, and toward the end of my time at EMP, there was definitely a movement to cut down on people's hours. But, you know, so many of these fine dining restaurants in the US, it's just, you know, you're working 80, 90 plus hours a week. And, you know, so that was a huge departure, and it allowed me to, you know, devote time to passing the MS, and it allowed me to write this book. And so it's, you know, it really, you can go and sort of, you know, give your all for a concentrated 45 to 50 hours, and then you can still have a life beyond it. So, that was a really big difference. And just, you know, I think living in a country that everyone's paid a fair minimum wage and everyone has health insurance just felt really good. And I think coming back to the US and just seeing really how many people are suffering in this country. Yeah. And it seems so avoidable, you know, after living in Australia and seeing that, like, oh, there's actually a way that the government can pull this off. And so, you know, so that's a major difference, and definitely one that is in the favor of Australia.
Absolutely. And I mean, moving there also, it seems to allow you to finish your book and give you the time to explore and finish writing the whole book. And I mean, there is a lot of other anecdote throughout the book, but one that was quite interesting for me, because I did a bit of traveling, solo traveling myself, and I wanted to, and it was very interesting. Well, you give suggestions. Well, how was your experience of traveling alone in Germany? And now it's not possible with all the COVID, but once this is over, why would you suggest it to people to go and do solo traveling?
Yeah, I mean, I love traveling alone. I mean, I think it depends on the personality type. Like, I like being alone. I'm very comfortable with it. And I enjoy it. But it does force you out of your comfort zone a little bit. It also kind of forces you to you know, be friendly with people you encounter. Obviously you want to make sure you're safe, especially as a woman, but, you know, when I was in Germany, I just, you know, I got a car with a good GPS and I, you know, booked little hotel rooms across the country, and I would just go and, you know, I emailed wineries and everyone was super accommodating, and I would just go and I would visit with them. And then, you know, I would usually ask them, like, oh, where should I eat dinner? And they would, you know, they would give me a list of suggestions. Some of them would call and make the reservation for me, you know, and just have a glass of wine and some local cuisine, and, you know, just really kind of get to absorb a place. And, you know, for me, it's especially fun. And of course, in wine regions, getting to, you know, see everything. And, you know, and when you're alone, you just do things on your own schedule, your own time. You're not really taking into account anyone else's travel needs. So I really enjoyed that. And I think for me, it really cemented my love of German wine.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a great experience. And I done it not for wine touring, but others touring on my own. And it's fantastic. And I think it's a great experience to be done. And I mean, there's another couple of things about the book and wanted to ask it. Yeah, there's so many different images, and there was one that stuck me about your cat, Bo. And obviously, where does it take your name, and why is it so important? How is it her? Sure.
So her name is, yeah, it's Bo for short, but full name is Botrytis. I got her in Chicago. She was... got her from a shelter, so she was a stray. And a friend of mine came with me, a friend of mine who had a car, said she wouldn't be willing to drive me. And I'd actually gone the month before with my mom, and my mom was in town, and we kind of checked out the cats and kind of had my eye on her. And then when I went back with my friend and she was still there, I decided to go ahead and get her. And my friend, who also worked in wine, suggested Botrytis as a name, which, you know, sounded like a mouthful, but then Bo is just, you know, that's easy. That's a nice cat name. So she became Botrytis, which seemed appropriate for her. As I kind of use her as a metaphor to explain the concept of Botrytis in the book, and different illustrations of how Botrytis can be, you know, a little rotten. You know, it is associated with rot, but it's also associated with sweetness. And so sort of use the cat as a metaphor to explain Botrytis. And my illustrator was so amazing. And, you know, I sent her all these pictures of Bo, and then she said, well, I need to see her moving. Can you send some video? And so I would take videos of Bo and send them to her. And she said, well, I'm just really not getting the full effect. Can I come over and just see? So, which is great. I mean, she's amazing. So she came over and she met Bo. And so, you know, it was funny because both myself and the publisher were kind of like, it's fine. Like, whatever you have, I'm sure is going to be fine. And she was like, no, no, I really need to capture the authentic Bo. And so, you know, at the time I was like, wow, this is a little over the top, but definitely in hindsight and with the result in the book, I'm super glad that she took the time to make sure Bo was perfect.
Absolutely. I mean, once again, the book is called Vignette. And Jane, before I finish. Before we have actually this conversation, in the last, I think, few months or couple of years, you had some, I would say, other chapters, and you haven't written the book, but there's some important things have happened to your life, and most recently there was this article that had come out, an exposé written by Julia Maskin in October. It was 3 months ago, and it was about harassment and all these other situations have happened in the court of sommeliers. And I wanted to ask what prompted to speak up. And
you know, I have to give a lot of credit to Victoria James and Liz Doughty. You know, Victoria had been involved, and, you know, I highly recommend her book, Wine Girl. And she details some of the, you know, sexual assault that she's endured in her life. And so she's really been a resource and advocate for other women in the industry who've experienced this sort of behavior. And so when Julia Maskin had written an article about a year previous to this one, detailing just a single individual who had, you know, perpetrated some pretty serious sexual assault and rape against a number of women. And so Victoria kind of acted, she didn't have an experience with this man, but she kind of acted as a liaison to talk to some of these women. And at the time there was a lot of discussion about master sommeliers, and a lot of women kind of had started to come forward to her and other people about experiences they'd had with master sommeliers. But no one was ready to go forward at that point. And, you know, the CMS still, but particularly at the time, had such sway in the industry. And so people were afraid of speaking out against these men and against the institution. So that was kind of tabled. And then, you know, throughout 2020, there was much more of a pushback against the CMS. You know, in June of 2020, when a lot of businesses and individuals were coming out in support of Black Lives, the CMS wouldn't do it. And it was a frustration for many, and several master sommeliers resigned in the wake of that. And there was just more comfort with speaking out against against the CMS and against master sommeliers. And on top of that, Liz Dowdy had heard a statement from the CMS that that, you know, well, we may not have the most diversity in our ranks, but look at how far we've come with women. And Liz was kind of like, no, you don't get to use us when your track record with women is actually really terrible to defend, you know, your possibility in kind of the realm of diversity. So Liz, you know, Liz and Victoria started talking, and they came to me, and you know, honestly, when they first came to me, I kind of really, you know, downplayed my own experiences, and I really hadn't thought they were a big deal, and I felt like I was kind of like got out of things pretty lucky, you know, easy in the scheme of things. And so, you know, I kind of said, well, yeah, I really think that there's a lot of bad things going on, and I would, you know, I would love to help you because I kind of have a little bit of a different circle, and I'm happy to reach out to my contacts, and I'm happy to talk to people. But I kind of like, in the beginning, I just didn't, you know, I thought I was going to be this sort of like resource, but like, you know, sort of invisible behind the scenes. And then it kind of became pretty clear to me that like, it wasn't appropriate for me to just kind of, you know, be a support system, but not actually sort of, you know, put myself on the line with these women. So I kind of made that decision of like, I should go on record too about my experience. And, you know, I think we all have different reactions to encountering behavior like that. And my reaction had been very much to normalize it and very much to kind of accept it. And, you know, and even feel like gratitude that it didn't go further than it did. And then I thought that, you know, at first I was kind of ashamed of that behavior, but I realized that that's like, you know, it's something valuable to recognize and discuss at the very least. That kind of was my impulse in how to handle it. And I think it is for a lot of women.
The article, I'm going to link it in the end. It's very, goes in a lot of details, and I invite everybody who hasn't read it to go and read it. I mean, what have been the reaction from the involved people in your own experience, and if there's any, how did you feel that the court reacted?
Well, you know, I think the court sort of has done sort of the minimum thus far. You know, at first they came out with like a really generic statement of like, we're sorry that, I don't even think they said they're sorry, but we, you know, we would hate for anyone, you know, involved to kind of feel any harm. Like, it was just very generic. There was no taking responsibility. There was no apology. There was nothing. And, you know, to the credit of this industry, people kept pushing them and kept saying this isn't an acceptable reaction, and including members of the organization. So, you know, the board, the existing board, the board at the time has now resigned. They elected a new board. I still don't think they've done a good job of trying to, I guess, address the harm that they've done. And I think that a lot of the focus within the organization has been on how do we move on? How do we reorganize ourselves so that this doesn't happen again, so that, you know, we regain the trust of the industry, and that, you know, the CMS continues to kind of do what it has done, is sort of the attitude that I get from the organization, instead of really saying, how do we address the harm that we've already done, and how do we become an organization that doesn't do harm, you know? And so how do we really become a positive force in the industry. And I don't think that those steps have been taken yet. I think there are a lot of good people within the organization. I think there are a lot of good people on the board. But I think, you know, I think it will end up needing to be a radical change.
Okay. I mean, it's all people that you've known for numbers of years for your studies, and it must be difficult to look at and live through. And given the people who haven't come out, what sort of suggestion or would you suggest to someone going to speak out? Obviously, it's not an easy task. So I wonder where would you suggest the people to go?
Well, it's tough. And, you know, I think we really trusted Julia Moskin at the New York Times with the story. And obviously she's done a lot of work like this before. And she's, the New York Times has such strict journalistic standards. So that was kind of an easy decision to go with her. There's a hotline with the CMS that people can report any instances of, you know, discrimination or abuse to. I do think that they are listening to those and they're being passed along to a lawyer to investigate. What will be done with that investigation, we're not sure yet. So I still think that it's a little bit tough to trust, you know, the organization that has kind of fostered this harm. There are lots of organizations out there in general that provide resources for women that have been victims of sexual abuse. And I know you're going to post a few of them that I gave you. And this was honestly sort of a new world to me. And I've become friends with a woman named Sarah Fernandez who was in the first Julia Moskin article. And she's doing a lot of really amazing work in the space of, just changing the culture around consent. And I think especially in the wine industry, you know, that's so has historically been so fueled by sort of late night get-togethers and after hours and drinking and stuff, that there's been a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of sexual assault and abuse and harassment, and we just need to kind of reframe how we interact with each other and look at these things.
There's going to be some educating needing, and as you said, you sent me a link of a PDF with all the association, which I'm going to post it on my website and on the link as well, on the notes. And I mean, looking at the future, where do you hope we should go, and where do you think we should make a change?
You know, I think the wine industry is a bit behind a lot of other industries in terms of where we need to be on a lot of social, I guess you could call them social issues, including sort of, you know, sexual harassment and gender discrimination, but also including, you know, healthcare and general labor practices are really bad. But then also, you know, I just feel like the financial necessities of this industry has encouraged a lot of these bad practices. And so we need to look at that as well, and we need to change that. And if, you know, if restaurants can't survive paying their employees a living wage, then they shouldn't survive. Then, you know, they're not viable businesses, and we need to think about another way that structure exists so that everyone who works in it can, you know, can be paid a living wage and have health insurance. And if that industry can't support those things, then the industry needs to change. So I think, you know, there are lots of organizations that have existed before this year and that are before 2020 or that cropped up in 2020. And I think there are definitely some more in the works. And I think we need to come together as an industry and create institutions that really support and protect individuals, but also businesses. Because, you know, you look at 2020 in, you know, let's say wine retail, and wine.com is having their best year ever. And a lot of these smaller wine shops are, you know, are struggling. And restaurants, of course, have have had the toughest, you know, the toughest year ever. And I think we just need to come together to kind of figure out how we can support the, you know, the independent businesses and the individuals in this industry.
Absolutely. I mean, 2024 has been a great, has been a year where a lot of people have spoke up. There's been a lot of movement across many industries and many different associations have come up. And I think going forward, hopefully, I hope there will be a better future. And hopefully nobody will have to experience what you have experienced and many other women would have experienced and any other problem of the industries. I really enjoyed speaking to you. And again, you've wrote this amazing book called Vignette, and I wanted to thank you again for your time and to come in here and talking about your stories and everything. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you very much. It was great talking to you.
You joined the conversation on Looking Into Wine with Jane Lopez. I would like to truly thank Jane to share her story and to share her insight here. If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe to get all the notification of a new future episode coming, and remember to tell your friends. Also, go to mattiascarpazza.com where you can get the links for the sexual harassment helpline, and you can also support the growth of the podcast in the donation box. The next episode will be on the practices and techniques used in biodynamics. What are they? Where are they from? And who invented them? A special thanks again to today's guest, Jane Lopez. Music produced by Samuele Di Nardo. Editing and mastering by Tommaso Ascoli.